Broadcasting live from the Wake Forest Business Radio X studios in North Carolina, it's time for Metro Raleigh Business Radio, where business leaders in Raleigh come to tell their stories.
Good afternoon and welcome to Pivot Points on Metro Raleigh Business Radio. I'm Fred Hathaway, your host, and really excited about our program today. I have a couple of entrepreneurs who are from the local area and who've been in the Entredot Associate Program for a while. I have Brian Chappell with Adapt Partners and Kyle Siree with OSNAP, and really excited about what we're going to be talking about today. So, Brian, welcome to the show, and just wanted to kind of follow up. I know you and I got together for lunch here recently, and you're kind of bringing me up to date about Adapt. Tell us a little bit about your agency and what it does.
Sure. So Adapt Partners is a full service, I call it boutique because we're smaller and that's kind of our market fit, boutique search marketing agency. So our specialization is very much search marketing, but the buck doesn't really stop there. We will very much advise on UX, design, overall look and feel of your website. But really what we're trying to do is drive more business to online properties. Most of our clients are B2B, but we do also have some e-commerce clients as well. And we've been doing this for 2 to 3 years now. I've been educated in search marketing though for over almost 10 years now. So
okay. This is a... So some people kind of draw a line in the sand between SEM and SEO. What are those for the novices, and do you see any differentiation between them?
Yes, there are. I prefer the term search marketing because I'm marketing via search. But sometimes SEM is strictly paid on the paid side, and then SEO would be on the organic side, but I typically just give it the umbrella term of search marketing.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, maybe are trying to figure out how to get more traffic to their website, how to get more viewers of their web pages. And there's so many organizations out there that hold themselves as experts in how to do that. What are some things to be on the watch out for, some scams that you know that some of the agencies kind of misrepresent themselves?
Sure. So I think anybody who guarantees placement is typically a major red flag. There's no way to guarantee placement unless maybe you're possibly considering the paid side, AdWords, where somebody can guarantee you the top of AdWords, but that's going to be problematic because then they're probably spending anywhere from $10 to $15 per click, and that's probably not optimal. So anybody who guarantees placement, that's a huge red flag. We used to see that a little bit more, though, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago. Those companies still exist, though. You'll get robocalls from time to time from them saying, we can guarantee placement, we'll set up advertising for you, or, we work on behalf of Google. Google has this Google partnership program now, and it's actually quite easy to get into it. And a lot of these companies will get into the partnership program and then set up a cold calling regimen where they just start cold calling business owners, or they explain like, hey, we work with Google. You should hire us and work with us. And they're kind of slick with how they explain that.
Now, one of the things that you said, and I have remember just very little experience with this compared to you, is that you can increase your bid to try and improve your page rank, but there's kind of a limit to that. There are some other factors that go into whether or not you get on the first page and the first few results, right?
If you're talking about on the PPC paid AdWords side,
yes,
you can increase your bid, and I think what you meant instead of page rank is quality score.
Mm-hmm.
So quality score is Google's metric on the paid side in terms of how relevant are you and how best do you match the query and things like that. And that helps, the better your quality score, the cheaper you need to invest for the click. But there's various things that go into that. So,
just stay on this one more second. So if I'm a small business and I've put a web page up and I want to get on the first page of results, maybe I can't get that to that number one slot, but I want to get on the first page of results. Should I consult with someone like you before I build my website, or is a retrofit easier? You know, kind of what's the rule of thumb there? You know, what would you advise?
Yeah, I would. I mean, depending how small you are and how tight your budget is, you know, it's going to vary certainly. But I think it can help to advise early as early as possible. We do see a lot of clients who come to us way after the fact, and unfortunately, they might have dug themselves a deep hole either on the technology side of their website to, you know, they might be hosting it on like, you know, a free website hosting platform or something, you know, not WordPress, but just like a free host, some sort of like Wix or something. Then you have to go through this process of more than likely getting them off of that onto a real website and then getting it reset up again. So
they have development costs in addition to optimization and marketing costs at that point.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, definitely want to get back to you and talk a little bit more about your business and how you got to where you are and where you're headed in the future. At this point, I wanted to welcome Kyle to the show. Welcome, Kyle. Glad you're with us today.
Thank you very much.
So, Kyle, last time I saw you, you were pitching a group of investors for your new business, OSnap. What does OSnap do?
So basically, the complicated version is that we're an algorithm for job seekers and HR managers. And the easier way to explain that is we ask questions, and those questions help us learn about what both sides of the party or what both sides of the equation value. And from there, we matchmake to make sure that people are happier in their jobs, more likely to stay, and that companies can spend the minimum amount of time hiring. And on average, we find that 89% of people leave their jobs or people leaving jobs voluntarily do so for a reason of cultural mismatch. That's a huge number. And it costs 50 to 150% of the first year's salary to replace them. So in terms of lost time costs, lost productivity, it's a huge problem that we're trying to address. It's also slightly a saturated space, but we believe that we're the only ones on both sides of the equation targeting cultural fit. There are some who do it only for job seekers and some who do it only for companies, and we're doing it for both.
So how does your business model work there if you're trying to serve both sides of the equation? I mean, do you charge both sides? And if so, what is your market rate?
So that's a great question. I would say that our cash cow is absolutely on the company side, which isn't particularly surprising for most people who've run businesses. And the biggest selling point we think we have is job posting, which is why you see so many of those sites like Indeed and Simply Hired and Monster that only post jobs or offer a limited suite beyond that. It's where you make a lot of money. To post a job with us, we use a kind of an interesting pricing scale where we don't charge one flat fee. We start off at a high level and then discount it cheaper and cheaper as someone gives more information. And what that more information might be is things like how much you're expecting to pay the person, what your average turnover is, if you want what some of the interview questions that you typically ask are. So basically both sides can come into an interview with an understanding of what the other one is going to ask and require. And you can have a conversation about what you're going to do for the company instead of who you are and what you're looking for.
So, you know, stats like turnover are self-reported. How do you guard against somebody scamming you and saying, oh, we have very low turnover already, we're just trying to go from 95 to 99% retention?
Well, I think that's kind of a difficult question. For sure, it's the same problem that you have with Yelp and a lot of other review sites where there's not a managing entity. And I can tell you that I review these things. I spent 5 years working as a fraud officer and for director of business operations for software as a service. So I have a pretty good nose on that. And from there, we're going to, you know, of course, ask employees at the company to actually verify that, especially if they're exiting, because they'll have a better sense of what's really going on rather than an HR manager who says we're all, you know, rainbows and yellow brick road.
Yeah, fair enough. So, you know, the biggies out there are LinkedIn, Monster, Career Builder, you know, outside of those, I heard you mention Indeed, but that seems to be more like an indexing kind of site than anything. How do you expect to go head-to-head with the heavyweights?
Well, we're fortunate in that LinkedIn does a great job working with businesses and sales agents and prospecting, and an absolutely terrible job with job seekers. Their data is usually pretty inaccurate on the salary side. They also charge $30 to $80 to $120 a month, which is a high premium, especially for most people in this area making $40 or $50 grand a year. It's taking you 10 months to find a job. That's like $1,500 plus travel expenses. It's a huge amount of money. So that's how we'd go head-to-head LinkedIn, as being a little bit cheaper and also providing hopefully a quicker exit to the job. And some of the other ones we're targeting a little bit differently. a lot of those big players, you can be something to someone or almost nothing to everyone, and you have to offer a limited product offering to capture those huge markets. We're identifying niches for things like women in tech and Silicon Valley. The main reason that that's an attractive market is women are twice as likely as men in tech to change jobs, and tech workers are incredibly highly paid. So if you're taking that 50 to 150% of the yearly salary, and you're multiplying that times two, that's a huge amount of money. And we think that those people, women in particular, face a different set of challenges than men do in the workplace. And we can help leverage that and help them find places where they want to stay and help workplaces attract women workers and female workers and other minority workers and retain them.
Great. So, I heard you touching on the concept of niche marketing, and certainly that's something that we advocate for all the small business owners that we assist. In fact, anyone who's attended workshops that I'm leading, I frequently say, if everyone's your market, no one's your customer.
That's
because
right.
or nothing becomes dynamic until it becomes specific. The whole thought process being that you've got to really know who you're going after in order to craft the right messaging and the right approach. Brian, how do you see that show up in your world? Somebody comes in and says, I need more traffic. Well, you can go a lot of directions with that comment, and how do you get them focused on niches?
It's interesting, because on the search side, you can kind of, if there's ever a medium to kind of fake it till you make it, search. So really you can really technically be going after everybody, but on the search side, it can appear, based off how you construct your website, it can appear that you're very specific in terms of who you are going after. So it's interesting when you brought that comment up, I was thinking, on the search side, you can actually do that quite well. You can make it look like, let's say you've got a website and you're selling, toys or something, and then you've got a specific section of the site that just caters to dog toys. You can almost make it look like all you do is sell dog toys in a way, and really you could be selling everything. That's just where, design and UX is really important. So if you're trying to fulfill that, making sure that your landing page is very much catered to the audience, the individual who's looking for the dog toy, they come to the dog toy landing page. It has a look and feel that makes you feel warm and fuzzy that you're in the right place looking for dog toys.
Now, I'm pretty sure I know what you mean when you talk about a landing page, but again, a lot of small business owners put up a typical 5-page website, and they wouldn't necessarily have what I think you're describing when you refer to a landing page. They tend to have a home page and, some type of an about us or contact us and, two or three tabs for other things, but not necessarily web pages created specifically for campaign-induced traffic. What is a landing page? How can it help me as a small business owner?
Yeah, so a landing page, in this kind of a sense, is really a page that's dedicated to a specific thing. You're trying to get the user to take a specific action, and that's key too, right? If you're not really trying to get an action off of a web page, then why build the web page unless it's just more informational, I guess? So most of the businesses we work with obviously aren't just trying to give away information, they're trying to make money. So a landing page really in a sense is a page that answers a specific question, and it gives the user the ability to take some sort of action at the end of consuming that information. So it might be a lead gen form, like submitting your email, name, phone number, to then get contacted by the sales team, or in an e-commerce setting, adding something to a cart and converting off of that.
So. Right. So I've heard you refer to UX a couple of times, which, is the user experience. Kyle, what are you all doing with your platform to create a user experience that's really user-friendly and engaging?
So whenever you have a software offering, there's always a knife's edge between offering too many options and not enough. And basically what we're aiming to do, we're still in the early stages of product development, so this could change in a month or two. We hope not. We hope that our initial suspicions are right, but we want to offer what will be most useful to the person. So I think one thing that I find difficult for myself, and I think others find difficult as well, is talking about who you are and what you want and using words that are appealing or perhaps in vogue for that moment or that specific job. So we'll be providing information like that in a very simple graphical way. And as people are writing a cover letter, it'll pop up and say, consider using this word, and here's why. You know, I can't say too specifically because we're still developing this, but the user experience, especially for our generation, being millennials, people between ages of about 20 and 35, is we like to focus on simplistic, well, pretty things and things you can take screenshots of and retweet and show to others and communicate and really feel like you yourself are understanding yourself better. So the user experience for us is focused on who the person is and how they can articulate themselves more fully, which I think has the dual effect of selling our product and also making people more likely to succeed since they know themselves better than okay. they would have.
Very good. So both of you guys are at least in the second iteration of what you're doing with your business. Brian, I'm going to turn to you first. What was the first iteration of Adapt, and how did you migrate from that to what you're doing now?
First iteration really was, you know, any kind of client who wanted to work with us, we'd probably take them on because we didn't have a large client base at that point. Now we're a little bit more specific towards the size of the client, you know, the culture they have, you know, the ability to work collaboratively with us. Some of these things are now something we want to more aggressively attack, because without them, you don't always fail, but can fail more consistently working with us. So we prefer to create success with all of our clients. So it's in our best interest to find clients that kind of match up with the type that we see as a good fit for us. So
so that's a change in terms of who is your market. Have you made any fundamental changes to your business model?
We have. We are going to be entertaining a specific sub-vertical that we're going to be more aggressively going after and creating a new business actually for that in the new year that we think is attractive. It's a completely different type of client, size of client and everything. But we see it as a very attractive kind of area that needs a lot of help. This is more in line with small businesses that you see around town versus the big kind of, Fortune 2000 kind of company, e-commerce, lead gen kind of companies that we work with.
And so in terms of your revenue model, you all have taken a decided position that you would rather have retainer clients than do standalone projects, yes?
Yes, and that was very early on. We knew that, and that was namely just through some of my friends who run other agents, very successful agencies, just, you know, hearing the stories of project-based issues versus retainer kind of situations. And then also just with the realization that, you know, especially with SEO, organic SEO, it takes a long time. It's not a quick thing. Anybody who wants to come and, you know, turn their business, double the business in 4 months based off organic SEO is it's not going to happen more often than not. So we need time to kind of see the marketing plan play out. And if a company is too short-minded, then it's not really a good fit.
So if I'm a consumer of retainer-based professional services, I pretty much need to get my ducks in a row before I hire you, because the clock is ticking, as they say, once the relationship starts, right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, if you're still kind of trying to figure out, do we need to build this extra part of the website, or are we gonna, do we need to invest in this over here after we sign them up? I mean, we try to establish most of those things with our initial strategy at the very beginning, anyways. So even if you don't have that perfectly laid out, that's fine, because we can definitely consult and help on that side. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not just search marketing that we're good at. We've also run and operated successful businesses ourselves on the side, so we have a pretty good ability to come into a business and bring to the table things outside of the scope of necessarily just organic SEO. So we can advise on maybe let's consider recruitment first, because you're going to need to create content, and we don't want to be kind of silly maybe to outsource all content. Let's help maybe, you know, frame that team early on, and then here's who you need to hire, and then we'll come in and take this side of it, and then this is kind of the end goal that we're trying to achieve together. And not all business owners have that fully fleshed out, and that's not necessarily the end of the world either. We can help create that foundation.
Yeah, I'm gonna plug your buddy beside you there. When you're trying to figure out who they should hire, you want to make sure it's a cultural fit, right?
That's right.
So, Kyle, your business is in .2.0, right? And what did you start out doing? How did you end up doing what you're doing now?
Sure. So, the mission for me has always been unlocking some of the levers that big business has for small and mid-sized business. And exactly which key I unlocked, I wasn't really concerned with. And so when I began, this is a drastic step. And people often talk about pivots as though they're a dirty little secret. But I think it's better to have a pivot than to keep on doing the same thing that doesn't work. So I'm proud of the change that we've undergone. But when I first started off, I was alone, and I was trying to leverage community spending, basically, to barter with big banks for lower processing rates for credit cards. We used to have about 10 million clients for my previous employer, and then we had 12,000 businesses that we served. And so credit card fees were something that I constantly discussed with them as a head of our accounting and finance. It's just a huge, huge money expenditure for a lot of people. So that's where I started off. Quickly became a very difficult business to run, because each client has such specific needs. And when you're working on a community level, the scale is really limited. And so when you reach capacity, that's as far as you can go. And I realized that I didn't really want a lifestyle business. And we brought on a couple of career coaches, and we're trying to figure out what we wanted to do. And the lever that ended up being the best to pull, we felt, was helping people hire better and learn more about what they find valuable in life. So it sort of came out of this existential crisis of what the heck are we doing? And I bet a lot of people are in the same boat. And is there a way that we can solve this problem and also make some sort of capital at the same time?
So who advises you? How did you get to the place where you knew you needed to go in a different direction? Was that an internal thought? Was that internal plus someone on the outside? Talk to me about that.
Sure. So we actually had a bit of a crazy week at the end of May. One of our co-founders decided to split off and pursue her own interests in working directly with clients rather than on the software side. Later that week, we actually met with Entredot, and we realized that we were trying to do a little bit close to what Brian was doing over here, consulting for businesses and lower volume clients and helping them figure out a marketing strategy. And that wasn't working so well for us because we didn't have a great book of business. We met with Entredot and talked to Brad Lionheart, who's one of your partners, Fred, and he advised that we consider joining up with the mentor. And we actually got placed with the mentor, who is a career coach and who understands a lot about, he actually is a passion profiler, certified career coach. And so all about talking about engaging your passions. And from there, our conversations switched from how do we monetize this and, oh my God, how are we going to eat, to how do we really engage who we are as people, and how do we help other people engage that same way? And so from there, it quickly organically grew and blossomed into a beginning stage. And so switched paths a little bit since then, but we've stayed on course for the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Brian? Do you have a mentor or an advisory group that you consult for direction for your business?
Yeah, I do. Barry Mitch at Pyramid Resource Group.
Mm-hmm.
He's been tremendous over the last 6 months, helping advise on a lot of foundation level kind of nuances that aren't always clear to me. They're obviously clear to him because he's been doing this for a long time, in terms of business coaching. So he's been very valuable.
So, when we talk about mentoring, that can be a very fuzzy word. That can be very hands-on, that can be very hands-off. It sounds like, Brian, you guys are a little bit further down the road than Kyle and his team, but how much do you rely on a mentor? How much time do you spend with them? How involved are they in your business? Let me kick it to Kyle first, and then we'll come back to Brian on that.
So you hope that they're as evolved as they can be. We spent probably more than five. Dontradot says you're allowed 5 hours a month, and our mentor is very giving. His name is Bill Spritzer. He works for Accelerate Solutions, and I believe he probably put in more like 7 to 10 hours a week. That might also have been like a lot of people have a lot of balls that we're juggling and figuring out if we can juggle 2 or 3 as opposed to 10, narrowing down our options and figuring out and making sure that we're targeting the right group that's achievable was one of our early on tasks. As for most businesses, you got to figure out who you're selling to before you start, before you make anything else. So 7 to 10 hours a week for him, I would assume maybe 7 to 10 hours a month for him, maybe 5 on a light month. What was the first part of your question, Fred?
So, you know, I asked how involved is your mentor? How often do you talk to them and on what subjects?
Gotcha. Yeah, so we talk to our mentor first for big chunks of time, so 2 or 3 hours up front. And then later on, we met once a week for about an hour, hour and a half, just to make sure that we had constant progress reports. And I'd say that the Bill was helpful in doing two things for us. One was keeping us honest and making sure that we are staying true to our original mission, providing us with those gut checks when sometimes we get focused or lost in the details, and making sure that we are still honoring the big picture elements that we set in line for ourselves at the beginning. And then the second part is just keeping us on track. Having an external motivator that you're responsible to report to can be very useful when generating a business. You a lot of times you get lost, or you see the trees but you don't see the forest. Like I've said, making sure that you're concentrating on the correct things and keeping you honest and keeping you on track is, even if you're really great at it, you can still use some help.
Yeah, good word there. So how about you, Brian? How involved is your mentor, and has that changed over time, and what type of things you talk about, and how much time you spend together?
Sure. Yeah, so early on, I shadow a lot of the comments that were made. It was a lot more time involved at the beginning, which is fine because it was a lot more to talk about in terms of just foundation, structural level things that we didn't have in place, you know, from legal contracts to administrative to HR kind of considerations. But now it's definitely waning back to, you know, kind of checking in once to 2 times a month. And so it's been able to kind of, wind back a bit. What's been most beneficial, I think, is the ability, the nature of our business, it is kind of, when you're dealing with Google and the way Google does things, it's very much like a roller coaster. And then you have clients. And I think if we just talk about clients for a second, most people probably agree clients can be kind of like a roller coaster. So when you kind of combine the two together, we can certainly be up and down depending on the day and the hour. The ability to have somebody to talk to and to get through like the never ending, list of things that might need to get done, and being able to lay that all out there and talk about it, and then have somebody who can kind of help coach you along, can kind of corral all the madness and make it seem like there is actually an achievable end to the week's worth of work, or month's worth of work. So as new things would come up or things would change, the ability to sit down and be able to talk through that, and kind of get a good plan and course of action, is namely kind of how we're using the time now, versus early on, in the relationship. So I'm still finding it very, very helpful, on that front.
Good. So at this point, what are the top 3 challenges that you, Brian, face as an entrepreneur?
Top 3. I think legal is a big one. Legal is constantly, there's constantly, considerations on that front. In terms of things coming up that you didn't think about, to then, well, let me ask my lawyer and then get advice on this and then take action on this or not take action on this. So legal is just not something. I mean, I went to college and took a couple courses on it, but they're by no means well educated and expert on it. So when you get into the business world, you're really good at what you do, but not really good on the legal side, and you have no idea about X, Y, and Z. So having somebody to lean on there, on the legal side, was a huge benefit. So that's definitely been one of the big challenges, is, and will continue to be a big challenge, is the, the onslaught of legal woes and issues that might creep up, or from contracts to various insurance plans to whatever might come up, on that front. Another big issue I think is really what to focus on the growth side of the agency itself. We have a ton of ideas. We're not short on that. Myself specifically, I'm the strategist at the company, so it's just how my brain works. I'm always thinking about new things. So, what's the next thing I should be focusing on in terms of growing the business? Is a huge challenge, just because it's kind of like when you go into the grocery store and you're looking at 465 boxes of cereal. Like, which one do you want to buy? Sometimes it feels like that's kind of how my brain operates on the new biz growth side of the company. So, which opportunities need to be addressed and which ones need to be completely ignored and which ones need to be maybe set, something needs to be set up in motion at least. So that way in 6 months when I'm ready to do something with it, I'll be able to act on that.
It would also seem that if your time is your greatest resource and you're a services organization, that it'd be easy to get sucked into making a client successful, and maybe you're not paying enough attention to your overall business.
Yes, very much so. I think you nailed that one on the head. That's probably been the biggest issue since I've fully dedicated to the agency, is doing just that. You know, how do you, and that's something I think I did a much better job of, especially with my personal brand early on before I started the agency. You start the agency and then kind of people stop hearing about Brian Chappell because I'm inside of Vidal Partners working on my clients, not focusing on myself or as much as I'd like the company. So then I'm kind of like stuck in a cave at the office, and it's hard to get out there. It's hard to network. It's hard to do all the things that you used to have, you know, a little bit more time when I was working in-house or working for somebody else at another agency. It's a little bit easier to go get out there. But I feel like 2015 is kind of be the year that I do start trying to do that more. I think talking on the radio show helps. That's really the first kind of kickoff it's something I did a lot more. I speak a lot more conferences and things of that sort. So, it's really, I think that we have to apply kind of the same process we would for executing a strategy for a client. We need a process for, you know, networking and being out there as well.
Cobbler's internally. Children have no shoes, right?
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So, how about you, Kyle? What are the three biggest challenges that you're facing?
So I'll just echo what Brian said. I'm also the strategist of our organization, and I do not suffer from a lack of ideas or interesting opportunities to pursue. Figuring out where I want to spend time, and also we have pretty limited funding, which is our first major challenge, is figuring out how we're going to pay for this venture if we're going to work full-time and then devote time at night and time on weekends to it. That slows our time to market, things like that. Figuring out what we can focus on, if we're going to get full funding, what we want to spend money on first, if we're going to bootstrap this, what we can develop in our free time without taking too much time from the other side of business, which is your family. That's always a challenge as well. I'd say that the second thing, ironically, that we're having problems with is we're trying to figure out whether we want to bring on another co-founder, since neither of us, my co-founder and I, have technical backgrounds. Or if we want to hire someone and pay them out of cash versus equity. So that's a major decision as well. It's of course funny that as a company that specializes in hiring, that we're having difficulty figuring out who we want to hire, but we're building a tool for that. We won't have this problem in a year. Right now it's figuring that out and making sure that we're committing to the right person. And also that person's committing to the right company in us, and they're not missing another opportunity that could be stronger for them. And lastly, I think that along those same lines, just setting up the right course of action for our technical developments and making sure that when we do bring somebody on, we can hold them accountable and hold ourselves accountable to them is a major consideration that sounds simple on paper, but when you get to the machinations of it, and you imagine over a 2-3-5 year period, it becomes inordinately complex. And trying to create an actionable plan for us and for the C-suite team, as well as anybody else we bring on board in the future, is a challenge. It's definitely mm-hmm. something we're wrestling with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet it is. Brian, when you first started out, were you doing ADAPT full time, or were you kind of moonlighting doing something else to pay the bills and phased into ADAPT?
Yeah, I had the benefit of having a couple other pretty successful. One was more of a side project. The other one was an invested partner in the company, and it was 4 or 5 years into it. So, and I've grown it pretty substantially. So I had the benefit of those to kind of pay the bills while ADAPT was kind of getting up and going. So yeah, that helped a lot.
Yeah, sure. It's important to have a bootstrapping strategy. You know, Wednesday night, out in the Research Triangle Park, Entredot's running a bootstrapping workshop because so many people know that it's too early to access outside capital, but they really don't know all the places they can turn to fund their enterprise. They don't know how to stretch the money. Some of them don't know how to forecast their cash flow, either personal or business. And so, you know, that's a huge issue. How about you, Kyle? How are you making a go of the whole bootstrapping stage here?
So I'm a full-time student at University of North Carolina's business school, working on my MBA, working on OSNAP probably on a bad week, 20 hours, on a good week, 40 or 50. And then I'm also working for a firm based out of Silicon Valley full-time as well. So I have an abundance of free time with which I pursue my hobbies.
yeah. Wow. That's a lot. So what's your background in terms of why did you become an entrepreneur instead of working for someone else? Kyle, what motivated you?
Well, I hate to talk about myself in this way, but it's the honest truth. And a lot of that's just frustration with working for other people. Sometimes you want things to be done a little differently, or you want to target a different mission. I think that our generation, younger people are very motivated toward the mission of the company. And sometimes working for somebody else, their mission might be different than yours. So getting to play by your own rules is really important. But beyond that, helping people in the way that you think can be most useful, and you know, both in terms of capital, which is king, but also, you know, human capital and spiritual capital is a very important endeavor. So for me, pursuing what's closer to my heart, and hoping that it works out and the mortgage gets paid is where I'm at. Just to reiterate, I think it's really important to pursue what you believe yourself best suited for. Gives mm-hmm. you the best return.
Brian, did you always know you wanted to be an entrepreneur? What kind of spurred you in this direction?
Not necessarily. I think what spurred me was just the fact that I was able to, part of it was certainly luck and timing. But early on in my career, you know, with the projects I was working on, just the growth levels that I was able to create, and the feeling that, you know, if I just learn, you know, 4 or 5 more things in between everything else that I just did, then I could probably kind of do all of this on my own, or close to it. And you know, the benefit of what we do on a daily basis is, things can be bootstrapped so easily. You can start a website for so cheap. You can create content, relatively cheaply. Probably not going to be the case so much in 5 to 10 years from now, if it's not the case at all right now. So don't hold me to that content is cheap statement. But the ability to quote unquote pop things off relatively easily certainly makes things a lot easier when you're trying to go out and do things on your own. So some of the things that I had started and created on the side over the years while working for other individuals and companies have kind of bloomed into their own thing. So ADAPT Partners being one of them. So that's, you know, I don't know if it was so much, one day I want to be an entrepreneur, but it's just kind of, you know, happened along the way. So,
mm-hmm. So we often categorize, entrepreneurs as being in one of two categories. Either they are starting a business to solve a problem, or they're starting a business to respond to an opportunity. Which kind of floats your boat? Brian's smiling. I'll go to him first.
I think both. It kind of depends. I'm kind of getting to the point now where I've learned that trying to do things that I'm most passionate about isn't probably going to pay the bills. You know, especially when I consider a business model and the most lucrative business models, you know, on the internet, more often than not, might be or probably not going to be aligned with something I'm totally outlandishly like passionate about. So it's more, you know, calling kind of following the money trail, really. You know, where what's got a good business model, what's got, you know, what kind of a business model is sustainable, versus like short-lived kind of situations. I'm not as excited to get into things that, you know, might not last. I'd prefer to get involved with projects that do have a good long-standing kind of sustainable business behind them. So like, you know, not getting to something where one law changes and all of a sudden everything gets destroyed because you can't do what you thought you could do because the law changes it. But you know, obviously you can't control that. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I kind of, it depends.
Kyle?
I'll pick one camp. I think I could also play from both camps, but I'll pick one for fun. I think that we're trying to mostly solve a problem. To give a bit of a personal anecdote, I finished my first graduate or undergraduate degree in 2007, my first graduate degree in 2009, and from 2008 to present, which is, I guess, 6 years, put in over 2,000 job applications. I've gotten 10 to 20 callbacks and maybe 3 to 4 or 5 offers. I have 2 top 20 master's degrees. I'm fairly personable, hopefully as the listeners, I guess, can attest to. Try to be personal, try to be a good person, but that's a pretty bad score sheet. A lot of other people in my shoes who have liberal arts degrees or non-STEM degrees also face a similar hiring problem. So it's not even work that motivates you, it's work that feeds you. Or if you're, you know, 50, 60 years old and you have kids living in your house, you're 30 or 35, you're going, how do I get these kids out of here? I think that that's a very big problem in providing people with, you know, work firstly, but work that drives them secondly. It's also an opportunity, but for me personally, that's something that I've wrestled with personally and professionally for the entirety of my career. And one figure I always bring up when I'm talking to people is I've never known a hiring climate that wasn't in a recession. I'm 28 years old, I'm about to turn 29. There's lots of other people who are my same age who've never known a hiring climate where they could pick between jobs. You just take what you got. And I think that figuring out a way to change that at least a little bit for some of us is a problem that I want to solve.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems like the biggest hurdle you're going to have to overcome is the way organizations hire. And anytime as an entrepreneur, you're facing the challenge of a new offering that challenges the status quo thinking, you have to do some education first. And to illustrate that this is a problem, here's how large the problem is, here's where it shows up, here's the impact of the problem, and here's what it's going to cost you if you don't solve it. So how do you share all of that succinctly, powerfully with your target customers?
So I think the easiest way to do that is not to target people who don't acknowledge the problem, but people who are asking for help very, very loudly. And that's why we're focused on small to mid-sized businesses, is a lot of these people don't have huge HR staffs. They don't have specific software that was developed in-house to weed through tens of thousands of candidates for hundreds of positions. These are people who are like me and Brian and Fred and everybody else listening to the show who understand that they want to hire the right person, but they have limited time and limited resources, and they need something that will work for them. Monster charges $500 per application or per job posting per city, which is pretty incredible if you're running a large organization. There aren't really any focused on small to mid-sized businesses that have limited time but still want to hire somebody who cares about community, shares their values and passions, because if you own your business, you don't want to just hire somebody who cares about your bottom line. You want to hire somebody who believes in you, your family, and everybody else who works with you. So we're, you know, education is definitely part of it, but I think it's a lot easier if you go into a relationship with someone who wants to be educated rather than someone who refuses to listen to any sort of new information.
So I'm weighing in my two hands here what I just heard Brian say and what I just heard Kyle say. Brian was talking a little bit earlier about figuring out where the money trail is and using that to help you develop strategy. Kyle over here is saying, where are the early adopters, right? And so you've got this intrinsic yin and yang between blue ocean and red ocean strategies. Are you familiar with that terminology?
Yes.
You know, if you've been to business school You know, a red ocean is where there's shark infested waters and there's blood in the water because the infighting for market share is so heated, right? And blue ocean is smooth sailing where nobody else is going, and you kind of carve out your own niche. Brian, I'm going to throw it back in your lap here, man. What do you think about blue ocean versus red ocean, both for your company and for the customers you're advising?
Yeah, sure. So blue ocean is certainly much more risky, right? Because there isn't that predetermined or, somewhat of a guarantee that you can actually make money doing that. A lot of our clients simply aren't on the blue ocean side. They're more on the red ocean side. I would say pretty much all of our clients on the red ocean side, you must have a thick skin to be able to deal with that. I've since job one, I've been dealing with a very hyper competitive kind of vertical, so I'm not necessarily afraid of that whatsoever. It's amazing what you can do on the internet with a smaller team over a larger team if you're just a little bit smarter and try a little bit harder. So certainly not afraid of red ocean. I think in the shark infested waters, there's always I'm a little bit of an optimistic. There's usually an angle that somebody hasn't considered there that can somewhat make you unique and maybe even start turning it more into a blue ocean along the way. So all of our clients do need a good, unique selling proposition, usually. I can pretty much guarantee if you don't have a good USP and you're one of, 50,000 other folks doing the same thing and you haven't considered that at all, then it's usually not really a good fit or something that long-term is going to last. Say for example, internet sales tax hit, your profit margin is 15%. Now it goes down to 8 or 9%. That's going to be tough, especially when you're operating, selling something that, 364 other people are selling. And all of a sudden Amazon comes in your market, then it's going to be tough. So you need to be thinking through kind of next steps if those kind of scenarios happen.
I think that's so important for our listeners to hear that, the temptation is to try and avoid competition that will make your job harder. But there's something about starting a business that needs to be hard. And you have to figure out how to compete. And sometimes that's by slicing the niche more and more narrowly to where the number of competitors is reduced by virtue of the fact that you're so targeted.
Yes.
In some cases, that is to say, rather than decreasing the size of our target customer audience, we're really going to focus on how we go to market so that we look very differently than anyone that's serving that broad market currently. And, regardless of what industry you're in and what stage of growth you're at, it's really important to step back from the trees and look at the forest again, to use that metaphor, and get a good handle on why are you going in the direction you're going, and is there some fear-based reason that you're not tackling heated competition? And if so, being frank and honest with yourself to admit that that's what's holding you back and find a way around it. Whether through the advice of a mentor or one of your co-founders, to get to a place where you can make those pivots in your approach to the market that will make all the difference in the end. Well, gentlemen, I've thoroughly enjoyed having you all on the show today. I think both of you have great business concepts and wish you the utmost of success in what you're doing. This is kind of a unique opportunity for me today because I am stepping down from my role of managing director of Entredot here in a few weeks to start my own business. And so as we've been talking about entrepreneurship and the reasons you go into business and what makes one successful versus another, I've had so much fun with this Pivot Point series of broadcasts that I'm actually starting a business called Pivot Smart. Because I've seen so many entrepreneurs who get to that critical decision node where they're trying to decide which direction should they go. Should they go to the left or should they go to the right or should they keep going straight? And hopefully I and the team that I'm putting together will be the voice of reason and experience that can coach them through those key decisions. Again, thanks so much for being on the show. Look forward to interacting with you all going forward, and wish you all the best.